This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Oh, Portland. Once again, the lineup for your Thursday morning coming up at 9:30 on Fight the Empire. The guests are film director Oliver Stone and historian Peter Kuznick, who talk about their new television series and book, The Untold History of the United States. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, host Dennis Bernstein speaks with Bill Meinst of the American Indian Movement about the battle for indigenous rights, and with activist Barbara Lubin about the ongoing deadly attacks against Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. At 11, on Between the Covers, we hear an interview with fiction writer Terry Bisson about his new novel, Any Day Now, his life and his work. At 11:30, Andrew Weymouth hosts another edition of 100 Tacks, exploring the area that was the Rock Island Clubhouse, a popular attraction for the elite of Portland in the early 1900s. And we hear an excerpt from a recent talk by Sut Jolly on the Left Media. That's all coming up this morning on KBOO. Up next, it's News You're Not Supposed to Know with Teresa Mitchell on Press Watch. Stick around.
Country.
When the desert sun goes down.
Hi, this is Retta Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree, and I want to invite you to a live music benefit for KBOO, Once in a Boo Moon, featuring eclectic mix of music performed by KBOO DJs. Included are Henry and Moggy from Swingin' Country, the True Vine Ramblers, Bluegrass from the True Vine, Don McLaren and his fiddlin' friends from Swingin' Country, and me, Retta Christie, playing swing music with my one-night stand band. There will also be delicious desserts and coffee, raffles and silent auction. Support KBOO Saturday, February 23rd at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church, 7 to 10 p.m. Tickets are available through Brown Paper Tickets. You can also find it at kboo.fm/boomoon2013.
I watch that desert sun go down.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
Watch, weekly counter-propaganda program. You're on your people-supported radio station, community radio, KBOO. Time for a truth data download and the news you're not supposed to know. Well, very proud of KBOO these days for a number of reasons. I really enjoy KBOO. I've gotten into the habit of tuning in the evening, especially just to see, when I can. I've got a radio in my kitchen. I like to listen when I'm washing the dishes. I've got one in the living room and one in my bedroom, and it's kind of retro to have radios these days, I guess. And maybe you're listening on the web, but you know, there is some great stuff on in the evening, and I kind of enjoy staying ignorant of what the actual schedule is because I like being surprised. Easy for me, I've got ADD, right? but KBOO in the evening, last night before last, Well, you know, there's drinking from puddles, there's DJ Anjali and Kid. I mean, it's just great stuff, and you don't get it. I mean, sorry to wear out the phrase, but you just don't get it anywhere else. Wonderful community radio, and can't recommend it enough. But this is Press Watch, and I want to talk about the news you're not supposed to know. And the question is, why is France attacking Mali? Of course, the official explanation is, oh my God, Al-Qaeda is there. What the hell does Al-Qaeda mean? These days, I mean, the word itself is just, it just reeks of CIA propaganda. Before Al-Qaeda was Al-Qaeda, it was our freedom fighter friends in Afghanistan when the U.S. was supplying all sorts of deadly weapons to shoot up the Soviet-backed government there. Oh, that was a while ago, wasn't it? And then there was the blowback, and now they're Al-Qaeda. So France is attacking Mali because Al-Qaeda is taking over, which means some people who are religiously minded are shooting things up for good or for ill, and France is going in. But there's more going on in Mali maybe than you're aware of. For one thing, there's a lot of gold mining in Mali. And it's a case where the gold reserves are just being realized. There's a lot of gold in Mali. And some of it's being shipped out, but a lot more could be shipped out. And let's take a look at history and what happens when there's a lot of gold in a country and it could be making certain people rich. Do the rich people just leave it there and say, gosh, good for those fill-in-the-blanks, Peruvians, Bolivians, Malians? No. They invade, and I'm sorry, I'm a bit of a cynic. And then there's oil, black gold. Oil is in the, I'm probably going to mispronounce these names, but it is in several fields labeled already because of exploration. The Tal Dini field, the Gal Greben, the Temesna and Nera areas, and the companies so far that have been exploring directly in Mali are the Eni, Sonatrach, Cellier, I guess you'd say, Heritage, Centric, and Africa Oil Corporations. Those would be variously Italian, British, Canadian, and Kenyan companies. There are trace minerals, very, very valuable in Mali. There is uranium in Mali, just so you know. Now, continuing with coverage of Fukushima Diary and the situation in Fukushima, Fukushima-diary.com, look it up. Cyanobacteria has been observed generating in mass from Fukushima to Tokyo, concentrating extremely high levels of radiation. It's called the black substance. For example, one sample was taken at 43 million becquerels per kilogram of cesium. And the stuff, it just seems to concentrate it. Well, it doesn't just seem to concentrate it. I mean, we're not talking just about a little bit. If you pick up this stuff, it'll actually burn you. And it's growing everywhere. It grows on roads. Bizarre phenomenon. But it turns out it is not unheard of. And what you hear in the background here is a little bit of ticking. Let's see if I can get a tick going here. Come on, tick for me. There we go. And that is my radiation monitor, which in the studio is registering 14 counts per minute. But returning to Fukushima Diary, in 2007, nuclear experts from the Albert Einstein College of Medicine wrote a report about fungi growing in Chernobyl. It suggests a possible relationship between radiation and the so-called black substance, the cyanobacteria, seen after Fukushima. Quoting, most dramatically, melanized fungal species colonized the walls of the highly radioactive damaged reactor at Chernobyl and surrounding soils. These findings and the laboratory observations of the resistance of melanized fungi to ionizing radiation suggest a role for this pigment in radio protection. Exposure of melanin to ionizing radiation and possibly other forms of electromagnetic radiation changes its electronic properties. Melanized fungal cells manifested increased growth relative to non-melanized cells after exposure to ionized radiation, raising intriguing questions about a potential role for melanin in energy capture and utilization. And that's the end of the Fukushima Diary post. An interesting phenomenon, a little creepy and science fiction-y, but I would hazard speculation that this stuff is was probably much more prominent long before things actually crawled and moved around on this planet, when there was a lot more radiation. And we know there's a lot more radiation, not just because of physics, but because you can find it. It's a reason why American indigenous cultures told you, don't dig up that stuff deep down in the ground, leave it there. You have to wonder how they knew. This is Press Watch, Counterpropaganda on KBOO Portland. There's a new push in the U.S. for tougher sanctions and war threats against Iran. This is posted by Jim Loeb on antiwar.com. Four U.S. non-proliferation specialists are urging the Obama administration to impose tougher economic sanctions against Iran and issue more explicit threats to destroy its nuclear program by military means. And a 155-page report, and the specialists who are joined by the head of a right-wing pro-Israel lobby group, surprise, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, said Washington should declare its intent to institute a, quote, de facto international embargo on all investments in and trade with Iran, end quote, accepting food and medicine if it does not freeze its nuclear-related work. Now, I want to speak for myself and away from the printed word here. This may sound familiar because this was done to Iraq for a decade in between the first invasion and the second. And the result was extremely brutal and resulted in the deaths of somewhere near a million people. I suppose that number is taken in combination with other sources of death, the U.S. being the principal source of death. And it is extremely brutal. That memory, of course, is very available to Iran. It's very much of a threat, the word embargo being used here. And it's all part of war making. And it goes back to medieval times. It's just as cruel, just as brutal as it was when a city-state would be encircled by, you know, some warmonger intending to take it over, take its spoils, and return triumphantly to their city. City would be encircled until people were starving. Sort of basic. U.S. does it. That's U.S. war-making policy. Anti-civilian war-making. That's where we're at right now. We're torturers. We do anti-civilian war. Isn't that charming? Returning to the text, the calls for that I was just referring to come amidst speculation over a critical meeting between Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, United States, Britain, France, China, and Russia, plus Germany, the P5 plus one, which have met over the last 2 months, in an apparent effort to unify their positions before meeting with Iran. That meeting has not yet been scheduled, but most observers believe it will take place at the end of the month. The report is titled U.S. Non-Proliferation Strategy for the Changing Middle East. Departing from the text, that sounds pretty harmless, huh? Non-proliferation strategy, an admirable goal. Returning said also Washington should increase Iranian isolation, including through regime change in Syria, and undertake overt preparations for the use of warplanes and or missiles to destroy Iran's nuclear capabilities with high explosives, only if Tehran provided meaningful concessions, among them suspending all uranium enrichment and heavy water-related projects, closing the underground enrichment facility at Fordow, accepting a highly intrusive IAEA inspections regime, should sanctions relief be considered, said the report, which was co-authored by some people that I've never heard of, Dubowitz and Albright. In that respect, the recommendations appear to reflect more the positions held by Israel than by the Obama administration, which has suggested it will not necessarily insist on a total suspension of uranium enrichment, a demand that Iran has consistently rejected and which many Iran specialists believe is a deal killer, as a condition for possible sanctions relief. More on that article. You can find it at antiwar.com. You're listening to Press Watch. And I want to talk about something altogether different, but something that's actually quite related, and that is transgenderism. Seems to be a bit of backlash happening these days. I would argue that transgenderism is healthy for this society because it is a militarist society, because it is a police state, because we express patriarchy in so many ways, and because we're addicted to hierarchy. And I suspect that our addiction to hierarchy originates with a hierarchy between man and woman. the hierarchy that says that feminism is bad, that femininity is bad, And we say that in so many ways, and we express it also in our hatred of anything that blurs the line between the genders, which conservatives would like to define very sharply, and in a really irrational and unhealthy way. Transgenderism, well, here I am. I'm living as a woman. I have been since 2001, and my voice is difficult for me to feminize, especially in the context of this program. I've always, you know, this is the voice that I use for Press Watch, and I've tried to feminize it from time to time. Doesn't work all that well here. I have a strong inhibition for various and complex reasons, so I just use this voice. But, you know, it just really gets people's dander up, and I think it's a good thing. I say that I'm the bomb. I walk into a room with conservative people, and they can't complete their sentences sometimes. But now there seems to be more of a backlash, and so humanizing worked for the queer movement generally. And so I want to sort of humanize myself, even though I've told this story on the air at KBOO before. I think it needs to be told a little bit more. I'm going to use my precious airtime right now to tell you about being a tranny. Why in the world am I a tranny? Why did I make that choice? And I want to stick on that word. I made this choice for the same reason that when you fall and break your leg, say you're skiing or bicycling, you make a choice to get immediate medical care. There's the pain, which drives you to do it. But when you go and get medical care for your broken leg, there are some things that don't happen. One thing that does not happen, people do not say to you, are you sure you want to make that decision? Have you thought this out? Have you thought about the ramifications, the costs? You know, if you're getting your leg set, the costs, well, you know, it could cost you quite a bit for an ER visit. But, you know, it needs to be done. Well, have you considered what that'll cost your family? What if you can't make rent? You know, are you sure you want to fix that leg? People don't ask that because fixing your leg is a legitimate choice. Wasn't it your choice to break your leg? Didn't that come about as a result of your choices to go bicycling or to go skiing? People don't ask you that. You didn't mean to break your leg. It's something that happened. And I didn't mean to break my gender. It's something I was born with. And before I get rolling on this, I would like to note that within the queer movement, there is orientation and gender, separate things. My orientation, mostly to women. A woman who likes women. And my gender, female, separate things. And let me not forget my trans brothers in this because, unfortunately, as a part of the backlash seems just at this moment, the flavor of the backlash is against trans women. But, you know, there's more than one kind of transgender person. Far more. So here's my story. I start with my memory. I remember 1961, I was 3 years old, and I'm standing over my mother's new wool carpet. And I am holding a bottle of, I think it was Lux, dishwashing soap. And this bottle is full, and I'm not sure how I got it. It must have been left where I could get my grubby little hands on it. And I am soaking the wool carpet in Lux. And this is really fun. I remember the smell of the stuff. Interesting smell. And the way the little line spread out and made little squigglies. And I was just having a good time. I was also doing this in retaliation and rage over a spanking. And I had been spanked because I had, for the second or third time, pulled a blue blanket over my head and said that I didn't say being because I was 3 years old. I just said that I was the Madonna. I was Virgin Mary. Yes, all I needed was that blanket, and I became this holy woman. This was something that happened in the context of many such gestures, because a terrible thing had happened a few years previous due to a chemical that had been given to my mother, unsuspecting to her, by an Air Force physician, given to her in huge amounts, in an attempt to save her life, I will say. I got born into a male body. and it was very confusing to me. And when I was 3 years old, I didn't know what the heck was going on. All I knew was trying to be myself, and everybody was getting mad about it, and I was getting spanked. So here was my retaliation. It was loads of fun. I got spanked again for doing that. I got spanked a lot. There were consultations. This was 1961. This is Fort Worth, Texas. The diagnosis was kids just acting out, and the prescription was more spanking. Keep spanking. You can actually find this in written literature. This goes back to at least to the Civil War. Intimidating children with spanking and various forms of beating. And I got it all. I got the hand and the belt and the what they call the switch. You have to say that with almost two syllables to sound Texans, the switch. And that was a stick. I laugh now, but it terrified me. That was the whole idea. And eventually, I learned to repress this idea that I was female. And actually, I internalized it to the point of self-hatred and ADHD. I remember when I was 10 years old in 68, I gave myself a little talk, and it went something like this. It's good to be a boy. Boys go first. Boys get to do more things. Boys go places. Boys are better than girls. It's good to be a boy, over and over and over. A little talk that I gave to myself in my room, trying to lock it down, doing the best that I could. I remember little breaks in that caused me all sorts of trouble. My sister got a book called The Little Princess. You may be familiar with that. And in The Little Princess, well, The Little Princess is a little princess, and she is oppressed in her little boarding school and made to be a little scullery maid, sort of, and eventually she's rescued, which I thought was terrific, and allowed to be her little princess self. I just thought that was terrific. I read that book over and over and over until I had dog-eared the pages, which was a problem because my sister had checked it out from the library and was getting in trouble for the fact that it was missing. And other people picked up on the fact that I was fighting with my gender. This made me basically a throwaway little faggot. And the throwaway little faggot is useful to certain people, so the local Boy Scout troop leader and his son up the street decided that they would groom me for their own sexual needs. A story that has been repeated all too many times, hasn't it? Talking about being a tranny, talking about what it means, talking about why it's important to the society that we accept the fact that there is a spectrum of human gender and that the gender roles that we apply to each other and to ourselves are largely false. Not entirely false. Oh no. Huge differences, I would say, between myself and a man, between a woman and a man, between the trans person and other people. But I did myself, I did my best to lock all that down on myself. I got BB guns. BB guns are fun. I mean, heck, BB guns, you project force away from yourself. It's like magic. I got really good at shooting. Many birds died. Macho in every way I could find it. And that was interrupted when I was 13, when my genitalia failed. It's called a torsion. It was rather painful. And I had to have one of my testicles removed surgically. I asked the doctor, I remember, am I becoming a girl? He took that as an expression of great worry, which it was, but it was also an expression of hope, which he never could have known. Or maybe he did pick up on a little bit. The surgeon seemed disgusted with me. No, he said. What caused all this? The chemical I mentioned was called diethylstilbestrol. Right now, if you look up diethylstilbestrol, you can find the major organization of survivors engaging in vigorous and careful denial of the fact, and I do say the fact, that it does cause gender changes. And that's because that's the way the society is. This society really, really needs to keep those gender roles locked down. It has to do with power. It's the reason why when you're in boot camp, I've never been in boot camp, but we've all seen the films, right? We've all heard the stories. Why gender is used as such an insult, and why aspersions against gays are used to control people in boot camp. Why the military is so obsessed with this macho image has to do with control. Well, at some point I had reconstructive surgery trying to be more male, replacing the testicle that was removed. I got into more denial. I experienced a surge in testosterone in my early 20s. Such a beard, so much hair, my body entirely covered with hair, such strength. Macho bicycling. My goodness, I could just tear it up on a bicycle. But that whole time, I also had the splitting of my psyche. I arranged it so that I would only think of myself as who I was in the evening before I went to sleep. I would think about my femininity. I would allow myself a few minutes before I went to sleep. And that's how I handled it for many years. And I have to admit that the testosterone and the macho and the hair really helped me to hold it together for a long time. But by the age of 43, I had to give up. There was too much of a strain. It takes a strong woman to break out of a man's body, but I am continuing to do it. I've grown breasts, I've grown hips, and this presented a new challenge. When I became a visible tranny, I was a tranny the whole time, of course, little phrases that were uttered to me. I remember someone screaming at me as he exited the bus, because for some reason, when someone's first transitioning, it just seems so much more transgressive. I guess it's more obvious. I guess it's not such a mystery. Screaming, "Look what you've done to my son." And I was saying, "Well, good Lord, what are you talking about? I'm driving a bus." I was doing my job, but he was talking about the fact, and he explained loudly, that his son had seen me and therefore was violated. I was asked, "Are you a man or a woman?" A four-year-old kid would be put up by his mom to ask that. And many, many other people would ask that loudly to punish me. There were threats of direct violence, and there was direct violence. There was spitting, and I remember a man who had a problem with a fungus all over his body decided that I should be punished by him hugging me so that I would be affected by the fungus. He explained this carefully and then tried to tackle me. I remember someone being so mad and reading from the book of Revelations that he was, he attacked the police who came when I was forced to deal with him by asking him to leave the bus that I was driving. And then there's TriMet, the bus authority that I drive for, has a little line in their health policy that says that no funds shall be expended on transgenderism. That's what it's like to be a tranny. And I would urge you to read more about it, because it has everything to do with imperialism, rape, gun culture, all manifestations of imperialism in this culture. And even the Pope is continuing to attack human orientation and gender spectrum. Golly, look how the time has gone. Stay tuned, because Per Fagering is up next on Fight the Empire. Director Oliver Stone and historian Peter Kuznick talk about their new television series and book, The Untold History of the United States, on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland. KBOO will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kboo.fm/2013MLK.
Good morning, this is KBOO Radio, and the program is Fight the Empire, and I have two guests today. I have Oliver Stone, filmmaker, and historian Peter Kuznick, and together they have collaborated on this really quite a huge project, a 10-part TV series, and a 700-page book on the untold history of the United States. So Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick, welcome to KABU.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, let me ask you, when did you start this project?
In 2008, when George Bush was president, we were upset. We wanted to deal with it. I went back to Peter, who was a teacher at American University, and I was doing a class there with him. And afterward, we talked, and I was curious about the atomic bomb and how that got really started. And he told me his amazing story about how that began, leading back to Vice President Henry Wallace in the 1944. Convention and how that tied in, and I thought about that would make a great documentary or a film, and it started there, the atomic bomb.
That was back in 1996.
That's right. Well, okay, you know, I might say that this book and the series starts a few years before 1900 with the Spanish-American War and the Philippines and all that. And it continues right up to Obama's term, so it covers about 115 years of history.
Yeah, we're still back in the Philippines, by the way.
You know, we are. Yes, we are. Well, it goes through World War I, World War II, the Depression, the Cold War, and all that. Why don't we talk about the bomb and Henry Wallace? A lot of people probably don't even know who Henry Wallace was.
Okay, Peter, you do the short version.
Henry Wallace has unfortunately been lost to history, at least up until our book and documentaries came out. Wallace was a visionary Secretary of Agriculture in the 1930s. And when Roosevelt was going to run for a third term in 1940, he wanted a real progressive on the ticket and an anti-fascist because he knew we were heading toward war in the near future against fascism and Japanese militarism. And so he insisted on Wallace on the ticket. And Wallace got the nomination after a struggle. And as vice president, he continued with his progressive policies. In 1942,